The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Information Policy Conference, Information Policy and Administration, here at the Washington College of Law of American University in Washington, D.C. I'm Dan Metcalf, the Executive Director of Collaboration on Government Secrecy, CDS for short, and we're very pleased this afternoon to have as our luncheon speaker the General Counsel of the National Archives and Records Administration, Gary Stern. Gary is someone who has not only holds a very important position in the federal government now with respect to information policy in general and freedom of information disclosure and transparency in particular, but he also has a very distinct background in that for several years, right out of law school, Gary worked for the American Civil Liberties Union. And as a matter of fact, I first met Gary just about 15 years ago this month when in implementing the Janet Reno FOIA memorandum that provided for strong disclosure, discretionary disclosure of information under the foreseeable harm standard, we had a FOIA community conference at the Department of Justice, and Gary came. He was from the ACLU, and he was part of the people to whom we reached out to try to make sure that we were very aggressively implementing that pro-disclosure information policy memorandum. And then shortly after that, Gary came into the government, and he worked for the Department of Energy in a high-level legal and policy position, working under former Secretary of Energy Hazel O'Leary, starting with disclosure of what was then called human radiation records, which was a major disclosure initiative that the Department of Energy had at that time, and then even more broadly, the classification of information beyond that particular scope that the Department of Energy had. And then, about a decade ago, Gary made another move to become the General Counsel of the National Archives and Records Administration. That agency, I should emphasize as I close, is one that has become one of increasing importance and visibility in this area for two reasons in particular. One, under the 2007 FOIA amendments, there's now an Office of Government Information Services, an ombudsman function that is to be established at the archives, and I think Gary will talk about that. And also, the archivist plays a role with respect to what we call pseudo-secrecy, which is the proliferation and use of safeguarding labels government-wide for sensitive but unclassified information, sometimes called controlled unclassified information, sometimes called FOUO, F-O-U-O, for official use only, and the like. There are many labels there. And Gary might be talking a little bit about that as well. So I just want to mention one more thing, I guess, before we start, in that when Gary so graciously agreed to be our luncheon speaker, he said, Dan, you know, I speak in a lot of places, and sometimes they don't ask tough enough questions when I'm done. We will be having a Q&A session, and I don't want you to disappoint, Gary. It's not only the volume of your questions, but just how pointed and acute they might be. So please don't please don't disappoint either Gary or myself, and please join me in welcoming our luncheon speaker, Gary Stern.
Thank you, Dan. It is a pleasure to be here, and I'm sorry that we have to. I have to talk over the clank and din of lunch. And ideally, I could have had a little lunch before we started. But in fact, what Dan didn't mention is I'm the luncheon speaker purely as a consolation prize, because about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I told Dan that I had an unavoidable conflict and could not be here for the afternoon session that he had originally put me on, to focus on inside the government session, where I think I really belong. And so Dan said, fine, no problem, I have an opening at lunch and you can have it.
Actually, I had to kick somebody out, but that doesn't matter.
So here I am as the luncheon speaker, and I was actually, until just a few moments ago, thought this is all about anti-secrecy and openness, and I happened to be going through the bios on everybody, and I couldn't find mine, and I couldn't find mine inside there, and I couldn't find it in the addendum, and it seemed like he was excluding me or trying to keep my role secret. Then I see it was hidden within our resources or something like that.
I think it's part of an old secrecy regime, yes.
So here I am, and I appreciate this opportunity. And Dan asked me to think about a few things and focus on a few things, starting with what's come up numerous times at this conference, the OGIS, the Office of Government Information Services, as well as CUI, and then if I have time, because I realize time is short, and I actually have to really be out the door at 1:45, I can talk about the fourth pin of the first day of memos coming out of OMAMA, which is the Executive Order on the Presidential Records Act, and as well as presidential transition that we've just completed, moving out all the presidential and vice presidential records of this administration from the control of the president and vice president into the legal and physical control of the National Archives. Just 1 year ago, I was at this conference. I think it was the first conference Dan had on in this area, in which I had to come. It was just a month after the 2007 FOIA bill passed, creating and establishing the OGIS in NARA. And I came and had to be here purely in listening mode, because even though it had been created, we at the archives were not in a position to begin to implement it, pending both budget and money for it, as well as sort of policy considerations of the administration. So I was listening and hearing and appreciating that everyone thought NARA was the great place and the only place this thing could be, but also hearing even more pointedly that if there's one place in the government the OGIS should not be, it's the Department of Justice. And then just about 2 weeks later, the president introduced his 2009 budget with, as Rick pointed out, a kind of a stealth provision, moving that office, or proposing to move that office by statute from the National Archives to the Department of Justice. And there was a great outcry and concern, understandably so. But then, of course, I work in the executive branch. National Archives is in the executive branch under the direction of the president, subject to those requirements. So we were precluded, really, from doing anything until that issue got resolved through the budget process, which it has been mostly resolved, but not completely resolved. As most of you know, there still is, in fact, no fiscal year 2009 budget passed by Congress, even though we are 4 months into fiscal year 2009. So we're all running and operating under a continuing resolution. But both houses of Congress did set up, or in effect reject that proposal and keep the law as is. But they also did what was essential from our perspective, which was provide for actual new money, direct appropriations for this office, so that funding to set this up wouldn't have to come out of existing and other vital programs in the National Archives. So both houses passed that, but the budget did not get finally approved by the president. The expectation is there'll be some roll-in omnibus 09 budget passed within the next month or so, which at that point we will have money to then expend on this office. So I'm here to say today that finally NARA is ready to embrace the Office of Government Information Services. And the proof of that, as many of you already know, is that we put out just yesterday a job announcement for the director of OGIS. And something we're hoping to do, and something we can do even without the money, we can announce for the job, interview for the job. We just can't actually make a selection until we have the money to pay that person. So we can get this process started in advance. You can go to USA Jobs, the OPM website, and it's on there. We've sent the notice around to many folks in this room and organizations to get the word out. We are looking for a director of OGIS. And there it is. Is that the?
It's an actual show and tell document.
There you go. Right there. And in fact, so the question is, well, what's our plan and what's our approach? Well, our plan is very simple at the archives. We hire a director The director then gets to figure out what to do with those and set up, create a whole brand new office within the government, which will involve hiring staff, and then setting up procedures, policies, regulations, all that kind of stuff. And so that's the plan, and there's not much more to it at this stage, although I think important to emphasize our plan is to set up OGIS as an independent office within the National Archives along the same lines that ISOO, the Information Security Oversight Office, exists within the National Archives. It's an independent office, reports the director reports directly to the Archives of the United States. So it's not going to be, as some people were wondering or concerned, it's certainly not going to be someone who works under the chief FOIA officer of the National Archives, which happens to be me, and or part of the general counsel's office, or just sort of, you know, kind of integrated into the NARA bureaucracy. It's going to be a standalone office like ISOO, and so that's what we have in mind. And now we need a director, so get the word out and get folks who you think would be really capable of doing this job to apply, and hopefully we'll have a good pool and do all the classic review, interview, and all for this position, which will be within the senior executive service. That was another holdup, as I told some folks earlier. We didn't have an SES slot to fill this person. We had to ask for a special permission from OPM, which we got just about 2 weeks ago, so that was kind of the timeline on OGIS. But one thing, of course, it's already been a year since the law passed and there's no OGIS. And a lot of folks I know here are frustrated. Why does it take so long? And I think Dan mentioned that the next panel, which is the inside government perspective, is going to give lots more focus on, you know, as much as people on the outside want things done and want things done quickly, when you're in the government, you realize things take a little longer than you'd like. Things always take a little longer than folks on the outside would like. And this is a case in point. We just put an announcement out today. It's a 30-day, you know, time period. Then we got to review. We got to have the personnel folks review, and then the executive review board review, and then a selection. Then it's got to go to OPM, actually, for the SES review board to approve, and all these things. That's going to take many months. And then we hire a director who then has to hire a staff by putting out job announcements and position descriptions. So in reality, the reality is this office, and then, you know, create policy, guidance, regulations. It's going to be, it's not going to be probably until the fall at the earliest before this office is really starting to do what it's set up to do, which is two principal things, of course. And the main thing most people talk about and think about is the ombuds mediation function of this office, which is very important. But Rick mentioned earlier, there's a policy review function. It's not an audit function. I got nervous when Rick said something about OGIS conducting audits. I didn't remember that in the law, and realized it's not there in the law. And we still have GAO to do the audits. We can review their audits and then try to work with agencies and the administration to make recommendations on policy, as well as to Congress to make recommendations on policy, and that's what we'll do. I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking, or just reminding folks on the background, because in the course of the last year, when the president, proposed to move OGIS from NARA to DOJ, sort of, you know, where was NARA in all that, and concerns that NARA really didn't want this position, which in fact is true. But which is also was very open truth, not a secret truth. There was an open truth. To review the history here, we were approached sort of in the early thinking when Senator Cornyn and James Ho of his staff were the kind of instigators of this whole thing, or among them, early on four or so years ago, and they approached us very early on. Say, can we, you know, they want to talk to us about this idea of this sort of office, including, hey, why, you know, would NARA be willing to take it on? And we very deliberately and plainly said, no, we don't want this. And we think it's a great idea. We think it's a fine idea. It's an important idea. But we don't think NARA is the right place for the OGIS, for FOIA policy And for two key reasons. One, it's actually not part of the core mission of the National Archives. The National Archives, of course, houses historical records and, you know, preserves and provides access to historical records. We also provide records management, and that's come up many times today, and unfortunately, I'm not going to talk about that, and that's a whole other conference about records management, electronic record keeping, very important things. We actually aren't experts on FOIA and on especially FOIA access and disclosure among current records, except to the extent we practice it, because we get FOIA'd, and I get FOIA'd, and Meredith has a bunch of FOIAs for my records, and we apply exemptions, but we're not necessarily experts on government-wide policy on FOIA. So we didn't think we were really the best place for that. I thought there might have been some other agencies or entities within the government that could do it better and more closely aligned with their missions. But secondly, and maybe more importantly, was a concern about, in effect, unfunded mandate. We're a tiny agency with a tiny budget, way overwhelmed with our core missions of, say, providing access to our historical records, and have many people in this room complaining about long FOIA queues, especially at presidential libraries, and that's purely a notion of understaffed, don't have the resources to hire more archivists to review presidential records, let alone the whole automatic declassification review process. We have a 400 million page backlog of declassified records that we can't open because they still have to be processed, archivally processed, and all that kind of stuff. So we didn't think we want to take away those resources to spend on this, and our grave concern that's what would be forced on us is this unfunded mandate. And that's why we insisted, once the law was passed, that we would not do anything, notwithstanding the law saying it's established that we got to, in effect, act now. We would not act until we got specific new money for this. That didn't take away from all of our other money for our other responsibilities. And that's what Congress has followed through on, so far with the presumption that they'll pass the 09 budget with $1 million to start this office up. And with that, we are happy. You know, once it's forced on us, and once we get the money, then we're committed, we're happy, we think we can do it, and hopefully we will do it, and it'll all depend on having a director who is capable of doing it and creative and open to making this thing work. So that's pretty much where it is with the OGIS. And so, give us some more time, really the rest of this calendar year, to get this thing now up and running, and then we'll take it from there. So that's the background on OGIS, and let's hope that it really starts to work. Let me turn for a few minutes on CUI, Controlled Unclassified Information, which has a similar story, actually, to the OGIS. Yet another new office to be created. And where does everybody turn to when they want to set up a new office on information policy? They look to the National Archives. And on one hand, that's flattering. We appreciate it. It indicates people think we are a good, neutral, objective and a fair place within the government, within the executive branch, to deal with these issues, and that's we appreciate that, and actually take it seriously to heart that throughout the course of this past administration and many administrations, we our mission has held forth as really independent, objective. With the core mission of openness and transparency. That is our job as an archive. That's our ultimate and core goal, is to make records available as much as possible, as quickly as possible. It's always easier, of course, to do that when we're mostly dealing with records that are already 30 years old or older, and which is the concept of the archives, of that delay period. So when it comes to us, it should come to us pretty much with minimal restrictions on it in the first place. The only two restrictions that generally survive at the 30-year mark are national security and personal privacy. And most other restrictions, particularly deliberative process, all the B5 things should be gone by then. And so we are able to get lots of stuff out quickly when it's old. When it's new, when it's young, it's a lot harder, and we experience that with presidential records. We experienced that. We used to experience that with independent counsel records, which by stat, which by that now defunct statute, those records of independent counsel automatically came to us when the counsel went out of business, even though those were very similar records to the DOJ criminal, especially criminal division files, which are highly sensitive, lots of grand jury information, which we don't get easily until they're 20 or 30 years old. So we've always had to deal more sensitively with independent counsel. And we get it with commissions, with independent commissions that go out of business. Their records automatically come to us when they're done. And then we deal with trying to open records that are very new. And we've had a recent, the most recent example of that, just 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, we opened a substantial portion of the 9/11 commission records that came to us just 4.5 years ago. And actually was kind of, I think, pretty impressive and effective that we were able to open so much, including we got a fair amount of stuff declassified, records that the commission created based on real, current, intelligence and national security information stuff, particularly interviews of senior officials and all. We got the agencies to declassify a whole lot of stuff, which is only in the 5 to 10 year frame, which agencies are usually highly reluctant to do, the intelligence and national security agencies are, but they were cooperative to a reasonable extent and were able to declassify and let us open a fair amount of stuff. So it's out there, it's in the archives. Folks are welcome to come see it, and surprisingly, there's been less sort of press and stories based on what we've released than we thought there would be. So anyway, that's a little riff on our core mission. Here we got the CUI, the program manager from the ODNI, coming to us saying, hey, they had this great interagency working group, which included every agency that deals with this issue, except for the National Archives, saying, hey, let's put this job on the National Archives. And Grace was on that. Dan, I think, was the first person who alerted me to that this was coming our way. And Bill Leonard, who's here, was part of ISU, was familiar with it. And he can affirm that when that idea first came forth, folks like Bill, myself, and others at the archives were a little hesitant and reluctant to take on this mission. Again, a concern about an unfunded mandate, as well as a concern about, is this something that's really even doable? We nonetheless, at the end of the day, the president's memo decided and established that the National Archives is the executive agent for this CUI office, and so it was put upon us. Per our mantra, money was made available. In this case, it didn't have to go through appropriations. The DNI was able to, generally intelligence agencies have lots of money, was able to interagency transfer us the startup money and commit to doing that at least for several years so that we could hire the additional staff to do this work. And so since it was insisted, we're attempting to embrace it. The memo creates all these standards and all, but it also says basically it's got 5 years to get this up and running, and that's a very important reminder. It's not intended to go into effect for several years, and so we did decide and determine to put this, instead of creating a separate standalone CUI office, to kind of put it within and as a part of ISU, the Information Security Oversight Office. Jay Basenko, who succeeded Bill as director, is now also the director of CUI, and he sort of has a third component within his office. That's the CUI office, and a deputy who oversees CUI. And so they're still in the very early planning and development stage. There is a CUI council that was established, and that meets, I believe, on a monthly basis. And now they're working on developing the guidance and training all the background stuff to sort of figure out how to make this work. And one of the most important issues to address and resolve is, in a sense, how broad does it apply? How broadly does it apply? Because as Dan and I have discussed and has noted, you know, on its face, you could say CUI applies to anything that is exempt under FOIA. If something is exempt under FOIA, by definition, it's and it's not exemption one or certain exemption threes, it is unclassified but needs to be controlled, i.e., controlled for against public disclosure. So there's a potential it could apply that broadly. I don't think that's the true intent or expectation. And there was a true focus of what they were, what the program manager office and everyone looking at this was wanting to address. And I don't think that's what the CUI office, to the extent it continues on its current course, will come out with, that it will be much more narrow and confined. And of course, it was established not by statute, not even by executive order, but by a simple memo from the president. And so, we will wait to see and learn if there is further guidance from the new administration and President Obama on whether to continue on this course or consider other approaches. So at this point, and I'm told by Jay that he's actually had to go to agencies, because every once in a while we've heard some agencies are already marking things CUI. They saw this thing, they're calling it CUI. They can't do that, they're not supposed to do that, the regime is not set up. And in fact, it's no expectation to use all of these new markings and controls until at least 2011. So it's 2 years, still a 2 year development process before it really gets started. So anyways, that's background on those two things. Unfortunately, I got to leave in like 15 minutes. So maybe I'll cut it off and conclude with just a comment on that executive order on presidential records. The president, he issued several memos, which are kind of advisory and telling other folks to do something. He did issue a new executive order on the Presidential Records Act, which on a simple point to carry through on the promise in his campaign, rescinded Executive Order 13233, which is the Bush executive order on presidential records, and put it in its place, at least for now, the old Reagan executive order, which was 12667. He gave it a new number now, 13489, I believe, with a few little changes. So we're back to the Reagan order model. And what's worth, I think, noting, and then I'll stop for questions, about the Bush executive order is, for all its potential reach and extent and concern that was around it when it was released, and it's continued to be described, this order as being used to actually block the release of all sorts of presidential records, especially by the Bush 41 for Bush's father's records and by Reagan. And that it was going to be used to actually withhold lots of records. In the 7 years it's been in effect, there's only been one instance for a total of 64 pages that it was actually used to withhold records by asserting executive privilege, which is all that this executive order is about, is the process for reviewing to assert executive privilege. It was only used once. In the time period which we opened 3 to 4 million pages of presidential records, it was only used once. But where it's a real problem, real practical, real life problem was for us, is it allowed for unending delay. And because there were no timelines on what the incumbent could do, and essentially we couldn't open anything until we got affirmatively heard back from a former and incumbent president, there was lots of stuff that was withheld for long periods of time just by delay. They weren't withholding, they just weren't responding, weren't acting, and it's contributing to our already very long queues to get stuff out. But in the last few months, they kind of completed their review of most of what was pending, some of which had been delayed for years, and said no privilege, and it let us open the stuff. So we, in the last 2 months, we've been opening a lot of presidential records, and in the end of the day, no privileges were asserted on anything from Bush 41 by Bush 43. The 64 pages were some old Reagan records. and which mostly were records about executive privilege, like a couple of OLC communications with the White House. Anyway, what the new order has restored was the reverse process, which is we give notice to the former and the incumbent president, we're going to open records. They have 30 days to review. If we don't hear from them in 30 days, if they do nothing, we can open. We don't have to wait for them to say okay and then let them delay. If they don't do anything, we can open the records. We can also give discretion to give more time and all. But anyways, that's a core and essential change. So that's a little background, and I'm happy to take questions. Good or bad?
Ron Collins from the First Amendment Center. As I understand it, said that the new director will come on board until the fall.
I said the new director, hopefully we'll have a new director in about 3 months. But then the director's got to...
Right. They won't be up and running until the fall.
That's right.
So that's 7 to 10 months. How will that affect the efficiency of openness in the interim from the period from now until that? Will that in any way compromise the efficiency of making as many records as open as possible or not?
I mean, it shouldn't. Remember, this the OGIS, its principal function is really to act as a moderator, a mediator, an ombuds for requesters who are frustrated in not getting responses from the government. Well, that's the status quo as we are now. So it's not going to make it any... The longer we take doesn't make it any worse. It just kind of leaves you with the current status quo. Hopefully it won't make efficiency... Worse, it'll leave it as is, but with the new Obama directive and with a new AG memo coming out, that should also improve efficiency, openness, responsiveness from the agencies, even before we have this office and this additional function of mediation in lieu of, particularly in lieu of litigation, that'll help make them even better. Next, Teresa.
All right, a couple questions. You've got $1 million at least allocated, even if you don't have it yet, for OGIS. And I think the ODNI gave you $2 million, if I'm right, something like that for CY. What is that even begin to be enough for each of those offices? What you really need? And I have a follow-up.
Okay. The short answer is 95% of that money in all the places is to hire staff. So it just pays for people. And you can sort of do the math on, depending on what level, what GS level, and how much they get paid, how many people. $1 million gets you about 6 or 7 staff. So you can start off the OGIS with a director and a staff of 6 people. That includes one, essentially a secretary, a couple 15s, 14s, 13s, whatever, however you want to do it out. So people of various levels of seniority, experience, and expertise. And that's what you get. And that I don't think anyone thinks that is going to be the end point for where OGIS should be in terms of being fully staffed. And so they'll probably want to kind of up ramp it over a course of a couple of years to whatever a fully staffed OGIS should be. ISU, I think, and Bill knows better than I, is somewhere in the order of 20 or 25 staff. At the end of the day, triple that, maybe it's $2 to $3 million is what you need to fully staff the OGIS.
The follow-on question is, or a separate question is, I know Jay Bosanko at ISU and CUI has some good ideas about how to implement the memo. Do you have a sense whether they're going to be moving forward with working with the public and working with others to sort of begin to flesh that memo out, or are they going to be on hold, waiting to see what President Obama says?
I don't think they're intending to be on hold. I think it's still an early development process, so I think they're working internally. I'm pretty sure there'll be a public review and comment, period, and involvement of public at some point. And I think, given that they're still on a sort of a 2-year time frame, they can continue to move and not stop waiting for new guidance from the president. If new guidance is going to come, in the next few months, even within the next year, that won't undermine what they're doing, unless it was just to eliminate it, stop the whole office, say go away, then that would be for naught. Right.
along the lines of new policy guidance, there were rumors regarding CUI coming out of the transition team prior to Inauguration Day, and there were rumors regarding policy changes and directives going to both possible extremes. And I was wondering if you have been receiving any information from ODNI or elsewhere in the intelligence community regarding speeding up, slowing down, or any alternative regarding expansion beyond the purview of the ISCPM's recommendations, which are limited to law enforcement, terrorism, and homeland security information of CUI, to additional or all controlled and classified information. As I said, there were lots of noise and often it was contradictory. Hopefully you or Jay can shed a little light on that noise.
Well, the short answer and the easy answer for me is I just don't know. So I can't help you at all. Jay may know, although not clearly he does. You know, a lot of these transition teams did a lot of intake, but not a lot of give back. I mean, even our own NAR transition team was mostly intake by them, and we're not 100% clear, although we have a good sense of what they were thinking. So I just don't know. Jay is not here, but and whether he knows something more and can talk about it. I don't know that either.
But so no specific strings tied to the implementation funds from ODNI?
Not that I'm aware of. But again, I really don't know the details. So, Rich.
I'm Rich Lund with the Sunshine Government Initiative. And we've been very supportive of the archives and since moving forward with this. And we appreciate getting the job description out. You mentioned the reluctance of the archives to take this on. Does this create a turning point where now you're going to be more able to be supportive and helpful in watching this thing expand out and grow? Or is this something where you'll just kind of, as long as Congress is given a little bit of money, we'll stay happy and we'll leave them space to do their work?
Oh, no, and I meant to convey that now that it's established and it's coming to us, we do embrace it and we are committed to it and committed to making it work and doing it well and doing it as best as possible. As long as the money's there and we got support as well as from on high, which we clearly do and will, then we're committed to making it work. We're ready and happy to kick this thing off and get started.
As OGIS gets up and running, has there been any thought at all to how the structure would be? Would there be perhaps a particular office or group that would work like with media requesters and giving them a different access and structuring it that way?
The short answer is, haven't even thought it through that much. We certainly got some intake. And I've gotten, been the recipient of the intake, starting with this conference last year, and before and since, and people like Tom Sussman up here who've just forwarded to me, other structures from states and even foreign governments, and in informal meetings we've had with individuals and groups, gotten a lot of input about how to do that. All of which are, where do you focus on? How do you limit it? The biggest thing is, especially at startup, seven people or whatever, you're not going to be responsive to everyone who wants a mediation. And so where do you break it down? Where do you set early kind of limited opportunities? And whether it's, whether it's media, whether it's sort of a high-impact request, none of that's been figured out and determined. I think that's what the director and staff will want to work on with input from groups on how best to structure this in a way that it can be effective, as it gradually ramps up in terms of size and staff.
And one of that thoughts to the office itself becoming a model for how to operate in the FOIA environment.
Again, we want to figure that out, but we haven't figured that out at all. And that's what the director gets to do, because I just haven't been able to do it or
tell
somebody else. This is going to have to be the last question, because then I got to go.
Okay.
Tom gets the last question every time.
I'll step back a moment.
Obviously, after a little initial controversy with the appointment, Dr. Weinstein proved to be very interested in the aggressive archivist. He's stepped down now. Tell us something about who the successor is going to be and how you predict.
Well, once again, the easy answer is I have no idea. And nobody, you know, the president selects the archivist for substitute vice instead of the Senate. And nobody, you know, is asking me personally, and I think that only anybody in the archives is being directly appealed to who to pick. Core to the job of Archivist of the United States is built into the statute is that it's be selected without regard to political affiliation based on qualifications, you know, historical archival qualifications. And quite rightly, as Tom noted, Alan Weinstein was selected by President Bush purely, I think, on that standard. He met those standards. He was highly qualified as an historian and was a Democrat and was not picked and was not a political choice the way that administration or any others could have done it. And so, and he lived up to the to that independence. And what most people may not realize is that position does not, and it was not intended to end at the end of an administration. And he could well have, as his predecessor, Carlin, served, picked by Clinton, but served for 4 years into the Bush administration. We had zero turnover or transition at the last time. Dr. Weinstein had to leave for other reasons. I mean, he had some serious health issues and elected to resign, kind of coincident, but not legally coincident with the end of administration. I think what few people coming into that job realize is how actually complex and diverse the National Archives is. And so, in the ideal world, we want someone who's both familiar with all the things that the National Archives does, you know, with 37 buildings across the country, dealing, you know, with a lot of just records management, record storage, presidential records, as well as federal records, all that kind of stuff. And so, someone who's both familiar and able and willing to manage a complex organization is what we want, but truly independent. From any administration, because as someone even noted, and it was talked about, Alan Morrison in the hall was saying, well, you know, presidential records, judge who issued the decision in the Cheney vice presidential case, talked about, you know, she couldn't do any more because the law precludes her under the Presidential Records Act in terms of judicial review of presidential records decision making while in office, which is true, and that maybe Congress should consider amending the law to give, in effect, give NAR more authority within the Presidential Records Act. But that could have unintended consequences. You've got to be real careful about, you know, how an archivist who works for the president can actually have impact and, you know, contrary impact directly in the White House with statutory authority as opposed to through good and independent offices, which I think Professor Weinstein was cognizant of and tried to be effective in that way. So I think that's it, and thank you very much.
Two things for you. I know you have to go very quickly, but the first, given the importance of the OGIS position, the director position, here's one that you might just want to put on screen. We're being broadcast on webcast through the university, but also on C-SPAN. Hopefully you'll get good quality applicants. The other is a gift from the Washington College of Law, but I have to tell you, this box is sort of symbolic. It's actually empty because the actual gift is being accessioned and recorded by the university archivist. Uh-huh. And sent to you in due course.
And I just hope it's under $20 so I can keep it.
$20, I believe it is. Well, again, thank you very much.